Chapter 6. Vortices. In this chapter, we consider an aspect of fluid dynamics often experienced in our lives, namely the localized swirling motion of a fluid called a vortex. After considering some everyday examples, we will look at the concept of vorticity, which captures the tendency of fluids to rotate. The laws governing the dynamics of vorticity allow us then to understand the origin and transport of vortices and their applications in aviation and sports. Everyday vortices. Our daily life presents many instances where the swirling motion of a fluid is concentrated in space, and thus vortices, also known as eddies, can be visualized. As we will see, the spinning component of a flow can remain in the fluid for a long time, facilitating our experience of it. The primary examples of vortices surrounding us are those in the weather system. We are all used to seeing weather maps on TV showing the rotating motion of large clouds, often accompanied by a familiar terms such as cyclones and anticyclones. A cyclone is a large-scale rotational movement of the air in the atmosphere around a low pressure point, which is associated with inward air motion and wind. Its size can extend to thousands of kilometres, and the largest cyclones are typically found at the poles. Due to the rotation of the Earth, cyclones always rotate in the same direction, counterclockwise, when seen from space, in the northern hemisphere, and clockwise in the southern hemisphere. In contrast, in an anticyclone, the rotation occurs around a point of high pressure, and in the opposite sense to cyclones in each hemisphere. The cyclones that are often discussed in the news are tropical cyclones, taking their strength from the evaporation of warm ocean water, and whose strong winds can bring about devastation. These include hurricanes and typhoons, whose appellations vary depending on their location on the planet. An infamous example, illustrated in Figure 30A, is the deadly 2003 Hurricane Isabel, whose winds reached 270 kilometers per hour over the Atlantic Ocean, leading to severe material damage and tens of deaths. A related occurrence of a vortex, but a no less dangerous one, is a tornado, an example of which is shown in Figure 30B. A tornado is a rotating mass of air that extends downward from the base of a big cloud. Tornadoes can be visualized from the ground because a cloud in the shape of a funnel is often located at the center of it. The strong winds created by tornadoes are often very dangerous to humans. They can lift cars and destroy houses. A smaller and safer version of a tornado can be generated in one's bathtub, or any time a large body of water is emptied from a small hole, such as in a kitchen sink. The origin of this so-called bathtub vortex lies in the quick amplification by the draining flow of any small initial rotation in the fluid, leading to the creation of a visible column of fluid and its interface with the surrounding air. Another well-known vortical structure is called a vortex ring, akin to a tiny tornado looping back on itself. For example, vortex rings are produced by smokers who use their tongue and mouth to blow smoke in the shape of a donut. A similar form of smoke ring, also dangerous to human health but for different reasons, is the steam ring emitted by active volcanoes, such as the one above Mount Etna, shown in Figure 30D. In water, similar ring-like vortices are created by dolphins and whales as toys. They first create the ring vortex in the water using a quick motion of their fins. Then they inject air into its centre by blowing in it. This allows them to visualise the water ring and encourages them to play with it. Vortex shedding. A canonical case of swirling flow is the one where localized vortices are continuously injected into the fluid. For example, when a rigid body is placed in a uniform flow, the fluid flow remains laminar and steady up to a critical value of the Reynolds number, above which vortices are periodically shed from it. This flow is known as the von Karman vortex street, named after the 20th century Hungarian-American mathematician and engineer, Theodor von Karman. This phenomenon has been experienced by many of us who've had pieces of clothing flapping periodically in the wind, for example while riding a bike. The simplest laboratory example of a vortex street occurs for a cylinder whose axis is perpendicular to the flow. In that case, the critical Reynolds number is Reynolds is approximately equal to 47, using the diameter of the cylinder as length scale capital D in equation 9. The appearance of the vortices behind a cylinder is illustrated in Figure 31A. This periodic wake structure persists at very high Reynolds numbers, as shown in Figure 31b, in the cloud dynamics of the atmosphere above the Robinson Crusoe Islands off the Chilean coast. In a vortex street, since vortices are released periodically from the rigid body, a timescale appears in the problem, namely the frequency f at which the vortices are shed. F measures the number of events per second. Using the characteristic size capital D of the body and the magnitude of the incoming flow capital U, a dimensionless number called the Strouhal number can therefore be defined as the ratio equation 24. This dimensionless number is named after the 19th century Czech experimental physicist Vincent Strouhal, who studied the motion of thin wires oscillating in the wind. Remarkably, over many orders of magnitude in the Reynolds numbers, the Strouhal number for a von Kármán vortex street remains approximately constant at street is approximately equal to 0.2. Consequently, when the flow speed increases, the frequency at which the vortices are created increases approximately linearly with it. The ubiquity of the von Kármán vortex street extends to the biological world, but with a twist. Many animals are known to self-propel in fluids, from fish and whales swimming in water to insects and birds flying in air. Flow measurements around these organisms have revealed that they also create von Kármán-like wakes, but with the intriguing property that the orientation of the vortices in the wake are reversed. All vortices that used to rotate in one direction for a standard von Kármán street rotate the other way near a self-propelling animal, and vice versa, so the wakes behind swimmers and flyers are often called reverse von Kármán streets. The change in the direction of rotation of the vortices in the wake is associated with the fundamental role of fluid dynamics for propelling animals. In the case of a traditional von Kármán wake, the vortices appear in the flow as a result of the obstruction of the fluid by the body. The vortices are therefore associated with drag on the body and a loss of energy. In contrast, in a reverse von Kármán street, the vortices appear because the animal manipulates the fluid in order to create propulsion and thus extracts some useful work from it. So the change in vortex rotation is intrinsically linked to the difference between drag, not helping, and propulsion, helping. To further characterize the fluid mechanics behind an animal propelling itself in a fluid, a second Strouhal number can be defined. If we denote by capital A the amplitude of the periodic motion of the animal's appendage, for example the flapping of a bird wing or that of a fish fin, and if capital U is now the speed at which the animal moves, the new Strouhal number, approximate Strouhal, is equation 25. Inspired by the discovery of an approximately constant Strouhal number for traditional von Kármán wakes, researchers have investigated what values of approximate Strouhal are applicable in the case of animals. As it turns out, essentially all known moving animals, swimming in water or flying in air, large or small, always move with a Strouhal number within a very narrow range of values, between about 0.2 and 0.4. This striking result suggests that animals have a universal way to create and manipulate vortices in order to extract useful propulsive work from them. Vorticity. These examples of vortices all have in common that the flow undergoes a rotating motion concentrated in space. How do we think about and quantify this swirl? In the 18th century, pre-Prandtl world of fluid mechanics, Euler did realize that motions with local rotation of fluid elements could be included in the established theory of fluid motion. The word vorticity was proposed to describe this local swirling motion by the British applied mathematician Horace Lamb, famous for his work on waves and as the author of influential textbooks at the turn of the 20th century. To understand intuitively the concept of vorticity, the easiest is to picture a fluid flow with locally curved streamlines. The fact that the streamlines are curved does not necessarily mean that the fluid undergoes a local swirl. Imagine drawing a small straight line inside the fluid. This line is called a material line, since it is composed of fluid particles, that is, of the material. Now we can ask, what happens to this material line when the flow moves it? Some flows transport the material line but do not change its orientation. These are flows that do not have vorticity. In contrast, in a flow with vorticity, the material line rotates as it moves along the flow. The vorticity, denoted by omega, is defined as twice the rate at which the material lines rotate locally. No rotation would mean zero vorticity, and the faster this local rotational motion, the larger the vorticity. However, why would a fluid have vorticity to begin with? In essence, the flow set up by any object moving in a fluid invariably includes some vorticity because of the no-slip boundary condition. Imagine a fluid at rest in which a rigid body starts moving. For example, a rock thrown in a pond. If we move with the rock and look very closely to it, we see that the flow near the surface resembles a shear flow, with fluid speeds increasing with the distance from the surface of the rock. Such a shear flow tilts any material line that is oriented perpendicular to the direction of the surface, which is a signature of vorticity. Through the no-slip boundary condition, the moving surface therefore injects vorticity into the fluid. No-slip leads to shear, which leads to swirl. This process of vorticity creation is used by volcanoes and whales to create their vortex rings. Similarly, no-slip is how we introduce vorticity in the bath upon leaving it, leading to its amplification during draining and to the bathtub vortex. The no-slip boundary condition is also at the origin of the von Karman vortex street from Figure 31, by forcing the fluid to come to rest on the stationary surface. Destruction of vorticity. Once vorticity is in the fluid, how does it go away? Since viscosity is responsible for the creation of vorticity, it is only fair that it also acts as the main mechanism to make it disappear. Indeed, the same physical principle, the friction between fluid particles, governs both the creation and the destruction of vorticity. This friction allows the vorticity to be diluted in the fluid, and eventually to disappear, through a generic process known as diffusion. To understand diffusion, one can use the analogy with the evolution of a dye in a fluid, for example a drop of food colouring introduced into water. Through diffusion, the initially concentrated colour moves slowly away from the initial point at which it was released, and by doing so, it gets diluted and decreases in intensity. Inject a small amount of red dye in a swimming pool, and eventually we will see no more red colour. There, diffusion has a molecular origin and results from the random jittery motion of fluid molecules bumping into one another. The rate of diffusion is then governed by a key parameter known as the molecular diffusivity. Diffusion is also the primary process to make vorticity vanish. Like a dye, any vorticity in the fluid is slowly diluted and eventually disappears. However, instead of molecular motion, the diffusion of vorticity originates from the viscous friction in the fluid flow. Thanks to viscosity, regions of fluid undergoing a local swirl are able to induce the rotation of nearby fluid particles, which themselves entrain their neighbours, etc. The rate of diffusion of vorticity is thus governed by the viscosity of the fluid. Specifically, vortices disappear quickly in fluids with high viscosity, for example honey, but are long-lived in low viscosity fluids such as water. Transport of vorticity. In between its creation and destruction, how does vorticity evolve in a fluid? How can we predict the dynamics of the vortices in figures 30 and 31? The fundamental understanding of vorticity transport was laid out in a landmark 1858 paper by Hermann von Helmholtz. A German scientist and physician, famous for his contributions to classical physics and neuroscience, Helmholtz explained in that paper how vorticity is moved and modified by a flow. The transport of vorticity turns out to depend critically on the spatial dimensions of the flow. Flows can be either two- or three-dimensional. A flow is two-dimensional if no flow occurs in the third dimension and if no characteristics of the flow depends on that third direction. For example, a wind blowing near the earth with a direction and magnitude that is independent of the altitude. Many flows in the atmosphere and the ocean are approximately two-dimensional, since their third dimension, the thickness of the atmosphere or the ocean depth, is much smaller than the other planetary scales. For such two-dimensional flows, vorticity is moved precisely like a material line made of fluid particles. Just like a dye, vorticity is injected into the fluid. It is moved passively by the flow, and eventually it diffuses away. Since no additional mechanisms modify them, vortices in these two-dimensional flows can be long-lived, for example, explaining the long periods of time during which cyclones inflict damage. If, instead, the flow is three-dimensional, Helmholtz showed that vorticity, again like a material line, can also be tilted and elongated by the fluid flow. Returning to the vertical material line element in the shear flow from figure 32c, we see that not only is it tilted by the flow, but it also increases in length. In the context of vortex motion, this elongation is called vortex stretching, an important mechanism to amplify vorticity. To understand vortex stretching intuitively, we have to delve further into Helmholtz's contributions. Vortex laws. In his 1858 paper, Helmholtz derived three fundamental vortex laws. He was interested in thin filaments where the swirl is very localized, for example, the beluga whale vortex ring in figure 30e. Seen from sufficiently far away, the vortex ring appears as a slender structure of concentrated swirl, called a vortex filament, where the flow rotates locally around the direction of the thin filament. Helmholtz introduced the strength gamma of a vortex filament, also termed circulation by Kelvin. At a given location along the vortex filament, gamma is defined as the total integral value of the vorticity. Examining a vortex filament from up close, we can clearly distinguish its non-zero thickness. In that case, it is sometimes called a vortex tube, with an illustration in figure 33a, showing the lines of vorticity and the local swirling motion of the fluid. Calling capital S the total cross-sectional area of the vortex, and omega the mean value of the vorticity there, that is, twice the average rotation rate of material lines in the fluid, the strength of the filament is the product gamma is equal to capital S omega. Helmholtz's first fundamental law states simply that the strength gamma of the vortex filament, that is, its circulation, takes the same value at every point along the filament. This is a non-intuitive consequence of the fact that the vorticity is a mathematical object known as curl, a vector field with some special properties. As a result, the strength or circulation of the vortex filament is a single number characterizing it in its entirety. Helmholtz's second vortex law, a consequence of the first, states that a vortex filament cannot end in a fluid. If it were ever to end in a fluid, the first law would not be satisfied, since the strength would go abruptly from gamma to zero. The only way for a vortex filament to end is therefore either to extend to the boundaries of the fluid or to form a closed path. These two options are seen in the elongated vortices of figure 30. Tornadoes extend from the clouds all the way to ground, and the bathtub vortex from the free surface of the water to the plug hole. The ring vortices emitted by the volcano and those created by the whale loop back on themselves along closed paths. So the structure of real-life vortices agrees with the predictions of Helmholtz. In his third fundamental result, Helmholtz showed that over short periods of time where viscosity does not appreciably dissipate the eddies, the strength of a vortex filament does not change in time and remains constant. This is a consequence of the conservation of angular momentum for the fluid, since the strength of a vortex filament, or its circulation, is in fact proportional to the angular momentum per unit of mass. Beyond the case of vortex filaments, this result holds very generally, and is known as Kelvin's circulation theorem. Vortex stretching. We can now predict the consequence of vortex stretching. Essentially, vortex stretching leads to an amplification of vorticity due to Helmholtz's third law. Consider a vortex tube, as shown in figure 33a, available in the print version of the book, where the flow has vorticity, omega, across an area capital S. If we place the vortex tube in an extension flow, as in figure 33b, it behaves like a material volume and follows the motion of the fluid. Clearly, the flow is going to compress the tube along the horizontal direction and extend it in the vertical direction, and as a result, the vortex tube becomes thinner and longer. Helmholtz's third law states that, before viscosity has the time to act, the strength gamma is equal to capital S omega of the vortex remains constant. The stretching of the vortex tube leads to a decrease of the cross-sectional area of the tube, capital S, and therefore the value of omega has to increase, so that their product remains constant. An increase of the vorticity means that the fluid rotates locally with faster speeds. This amplification is therefore a direct consequence of the stretching of vortex lines by the flow. Physically, This amplification of the swirling is due to the conservation of angular momentum. A famous illustration of this principle in a non-fluid mechanics context is used by spinning figure skaters who bring their arms closer to their body so as to increase their rate of rotation. The change in the position of the arms of a figure skater plays the same role as the decrease in the area of the vortex tube, and both are accompanied by a faster rotation in order to conserve angular momentum. The amplification of vorticity by extension flow plays an important role in the dynamics of tornadoes. In the summer, the air near the ground is warmed up by sunlight, so it becomes lighter and rises. Because of conservation of mass, if that air goes up vertically, then some other air has to move horizontally in order to replenish it. The airflow near the ground is therefore similar to the extension flow from figure 33b, amplifying the rotation of any swirling flow and helping strengthen tornadoes. The same principle applies in the bathtub vortex of figure 30c. In that case, the drainage flow near the plug hole is also a local extension, and thus any remnant vorticity in the fluid gets strongly amplified, leading to a strong eddy. Aeroplane vortices and lift. One everyday example where vortices are critical is the flight of aeroplanes. When a plane accelerates prior to taking off, the very sudden acceleration of its wings relative to the surrounding air leads to the creation, through the action of viscosity, of a large rotational structure called a starting vortex. This eddy, which rotates in the counterclockwise direction when observing the plane moving from right to left, remains on the runway until it eventually decays due to viscosity. The starting vortex turns out to be the important physical ingredient allowing the plane to take off and fly, due to the laws derived by Helmholtz. Consider the airflow surrounding the entire aeroplane. Initially, there is no motion, so the fluid is at rest and the vorticity is zero everywhere. Helmholtz's third law, or Kelvin's circulation theorem, says that the total circulation of the flow must remain equal to zero. However, because a starting vortex is left behind, it means that the wing must necessarily carry with it an equal and opposite vortex. Due to the starting vortex, a movement of air is always induced around the wing in the clockwise direction when observing the wing going from right to left. This flow is called the wing circulation. Wing circulation is what allows aeroplanes to fly through the generation of lift. The fluid mechanical forces exerted on bodies moving in fluid are of two types, drag and lift. Drag is the force in the direction opposite to motion, as discussed in Chapter 5. Lift, in contrast, is the force exerted by the moving fluid on the body in the direction perpendicular to the motion. Since an aeroplane aims to move horizontally, it needs lift in the vertical direction in order to balance its weight, allowing it to take off and fly. So the lift force exerted on aeroplane wings is the key feature allowing flight in the first place. Why does wing circulation generate lift? We can understand it intuitively by examining the airflow around the wing during flight. Moving with the wing, we see that it experiences a strong air wind and can compare the speed of the wind above the wing, U sub top, to the one below it, U sub below. If the wing carries no circulation, we have approximately U sub top is equal to U sub below. So, by invoking Bernoulli's equation, the flow exerts identical pressure above and below, and therefore no net lift force is exerted on the wing. Things are, however, very different for a wing with circulation. As illustrated in Figure 34, the effect of wing circulation is to induce an additional flow of air. Above the wing, that flow goes in the same direction as the outside wind, while below the wing, it goes in the opposite direction, that is, against the wind. Comparing the total speed of the airflow above and below the wing, we see that now U sub top is greater than U sub below. If the airflow above the wing is faster than below, then Bernoulli's equation says that the flow pressure above the wing is smaller than that below it. That is, P sub top is less than P sub below. This difference in pressure leads to a net force pushing vertically upward on the wing. In other words, lift. This mechanism of lift generation is subtle. First, a starting vortex has to be created to ensure that the wing carries with it an equal and opposite circulation. Second, that starting vortex needs to rotate in a specific direction. Indeed, a starting vortex rotating the other way than in figure 34 changes the direction of the circulation around the wing, and the upward lift becomes a downward one with no hope for takeoff or flight. Third, the strength of starting vortex needs to be sufficiently large to generate a lift strong enough to balance the full weight of the plane. All these important properties turn out to be set by the shape and the size of the wing. In addition to the starting vortex and wing circulation, the motion of airplane wings also leads to additional vortex filaments aligned in the direction of flight, and therefore perpendicular to the wings. Called trailing vortices, they are visualised in figure 34C behind a Lockheed L-1011 TriStar using smoke generators, but can also be seen naturally thanks to the condensation of water vapour from the atmosphere at the centre of the vortices. These vortex filaments are unstable, so from long and smooth tubes they quickly transition to wavy filaments, leaving streaks in the sky that can often be seen long after the plane has disappeared from view. Magnus effect and vorticity in sport. The dynamics of sports balls is another situation where lift is present. The lift allowing aeroplanes to fly was due to the starting vortex inducing flow circulation around the wing. Alternatively, this circulation can be generated by spinning the body moving in the fluid, and in that case, it is called the Magnus effect, after the 19th century German chemist and physicist Heinrich Magnus. During ball games, the Magnus effect is used by adept players to manipulate the motion of the balls. The Magnus effect can be illustrated using the example of tennis, as in figure 35, where two popular techniques based on it can be used to modify the trajectory of a ball. The first one is called backspin, where the player hits the ball while slicing it downward. This leads to a rotation that, when observing the ball moving from right to left, is in the clockwise direction. Using the same physical arguments as those explaining the lift on aeroplanes, we see that backspin also leads to an upward lift force. As a result of backspin, balls spend more time in the air, with a bell-like curve, giving the player extra time, for example, to run to the net. The second technique is called topspin, in which the player hits the ball while slicing it upward. In that case, the rotation of the ball is in the counterclockwise direction. Due to the change in rotation direction as compared to backspin, the ball experiences a downward lift, which accelerates its descent. To prevent the ball from dropping too soon and touching the net, topspin requires tennis players to hit strongly and is thus associated with fast balls. Beyond tennis, the same Magnus effect is at play in multiple ball games. In table tennis, the ball is light and thus easy to spin even by casual players. In baseball, pitchers who throw the ball can use their fingers to give it a rotation as it leaves their hands. In volleyball, during serves, players often add spin to the ball to control the time it spends in the air. Another popular use of the Magnus effect in sports are kicks in football. An infamous example is a 1997 free kick by Roberto Carlos for Brazil in a game against France. The initial trajectory of the ball projected it to finish far from the goal, but, thanks to strong side spin, the ball curved back into the net. A different example in football is the Panenka penalty kick, where a slow kick with backspin gives the ball a bell curve trajectory above the goalkeeper.